affected, causing no damage to the maneuvering warship other than a slight drain in her shield strength. Their mission now was one of deception and diversion, not of destruction, and Nathan intended to get the Doosan's undivided attention and hold it for as long as possible. "Target's shields are down 10%, Lieutenant Commander Kona reported from the sensor station. "They're locking missile on us." "I've got at least a dozen warships on my threat board," Jessica announced. "I'm locking jump missiles onto all of them with full recovery safeties." "Target is firing," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned, as if it was necessary. A second later, the Aurora shook from the impacts of the Doosan cruiser's incoming weapons fire and continued to shake with every impact. "I've got solutions on 8 of 13 targets," Jessica reported. "Launching 16. "Prepare to pitch onto them and jump forward 10 light seconds," Nathan instructed. "We need them to keep sight of us while we evade their missiles." "Target is launching," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned. "Missiles away," Jessica added. "Pitching down," Lieutenant Deneve reported as the image of the cruiser began to slide upward on the main view screen. The stream of plasma torpedoes leaving the Aurora stopped as their aim was interrupted by the change in pitch attitude. There was a low rumble mixed with the violent vibrations of the incoming weapons fire as the Aurora's main engines fired to help change her course. "Point defenses are firing," Jessica proclaimed. "Missile impacts in 5 seconds," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned. 3, 2, clear jump line," Mr. Bickle reported. 1, jump," Nathan snapped before the words had cleared the ensign's lips. The jump flash washed over the bridge and the image of the cruiser disappeared from their main view screen, replaced by the planet Takara and 2 frigates that were coming over the planet's horizon. "Turn to those frigates and jump us ahead to point-blank range," Nathan ordered. "Turning, aye," the helmsman replied. "Plotting jump." "I have 6 missile impacts, Jessica declared. "Target damage assessments when able," Nathan urged his sensor officer. "Working on it," she replied. "Jump is ready," Mr. Bickle reported. "Ready all tubes and turrets," Nathan ordered. "Jump." The jump flash again washed over the bridge. The planet grew in size, filling more of the view screen, as did both of the frigates, since they too were now much closer than a few seconds ago. "Firing all tubes and turrets," Jessica announced. Again, a stream of plasma torpedoes, departing in groups of 4, mixed in with 6 streams of plasma bolts from the quad-barreled plasma cannon turrets along the bow of the Aurora. Both frigates immediately turned away, their shields flashing with each impact of plasma. A split second later, the 2 frigates jumped to safety. "Jump flash directly astern," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned. "The cruiser has moved in behind us." "Jump forward 1 light minute. Nathan ordered. "Start a standard rate turn to port after we jump and come about on a reciprocal heading."
"Aye, sir."
"Multiple contacts," Lieutenant Commander Kona warned. "Now showing 2 Doosan battleships, 3 cruisers, and 4 frigates, she reported, feeling overwhelmed. "And that's not including all the gunships and non-military traffic swarming about." "This place is a traffic controller's nightmare," Lieutenant Deneve commented under her breath as the next jump flash washed over them. 6 crawlers suddenly appeared only 50 meters beyond the orbital shipyard superstructure that surrounded the Tienta. No jump flashes announced their presence. They simply came into existence, as if from nowhere. They coasted toward the Tienta below them, firing thrusters to steer between the trusses that encompassed the massive battleship. Lieutenant Rezik immediately switched on his transponder, spoofing the identification codes provided by Suvan Navarro so that, to the shipyard controllers, they would appear as duplicates of existing crawlers and would likely be attributed to a computer glitch. He checked his display, noting that his men had done likewise and that all 6 crawlers were now squawking expected ID codes. The lieutenant carefully manipulated his controls, steering his crawler through the trusswork structure. Once passed, he altered his course just enough to steer toward the section of the hull that lay directly over the main engineering portion of the warship. The meters counted away quickly as he closed on the massive vessel. At the last moment, he fired his thrusters again, and then slightly coiled the arms on his crawler to better absorb the impact of touchdown. In near unison, all 6 crawlers touched down on the outer hull of the Takaran battleship. 3 of the crawlers moved immediately into position and began cutting a circle through the hull in coordinated fashion, while the other 3 crawlers pointed their side-mounted fixed mini-plasma cannons outward, taking defensive postures. Two Ronnie jump shuttles appeared as if from nowhere and without any jump flashes, just outside of the shipyard, on collision courses with the Tayenta. They too steered through the truss work surrounding the ship and then ducked into her starboard flight deck bay, disappearing from sight. Once inside the bay, the shuttles decelerated sharply, turning toward the large door which led from the bay into the starboard hangar deck. Suvan Navarro powered up his crawler and immediately moved it to one side of the hangar door frame, activating his mag locks at full power. He pressed the button on the remote detonator. There was a flash of light and his crawler shook. A split second later, something hit one of his canopy windows, scaring the daylights out of him. He heard a hissing sound and looked to his right. Just above his right ear, something, probably a piece of the blast door, had slammed into the little window and cracked it. He was now leaking air, likely having only minutes before he would be in full vacuum and would be dead. He immediately deactivated his mag locks and crawled furiously through the now open bay doorway, seeking refuge inside. If he could just get to one of the crawler docks in the starboard hangar bay in time, he might still get out of the crawler and into the pressurized interior of the Tayenta before it was too late. One after another, each of the four Cobra gunships jumped into the Takar system. Upon arrival, they each turned toward different targets and jumped again, arriving near their intended targets a split second later. The idea was to create the illusion of an all-out attack against the Dusan fleet, and so far it appeared to be working. One by one, the Dusan warships began moving away from the shipyard to engage the Aurora and the newly arrived gunships. "Dusan battleship 20 degrees to port slightly below us," Lieutenant Commander Kono reported. "Turn into the battleship and jump us over her to a position 30 light seconds beyond, then come about to jump back and attack. They'll get a read on us before we finish the turn," Lieutenant Deneuve reminded her captain. "Let's hope so," Nathan replied. "Just to make it look good, let's first jump even with her on our side and slap her with our port broadsides," Nathan suggested. "Just to piss them off?" Jessica commented as her fingers danced across the tactical console, selecting targets for the Aurora's weapons. "Gotta put on a good show," Nathan replied. "Lieutenant?"
"I've got it, sir."
"Both jumps are plotted and ready," Mr. Bickle announced. "Roll us onto our port side as you come out of your turn, Lieutenant," Nathan ordered.
"Aye, sir."
The Aurora came out of her turn to port, then rolled onto her port side, jumping ahead several kilometers as her roll completed, and coming out even with and directly above the enemy battleship. The much smaller ship's weapons immediately began to fire. Railguns, plasma cannon turrets, and finally the Mark III broadside plasma cannons on her aft port side all blasted away at the much larger ship's shields as the Aurora slid over the enemy vessel. The black and crimson battleship returned fire seconds later, pummeling the Aurora's shields as well, and with considerably greater firepower. Within seconds, the Aurora's shields began to show signs of failing, a state made obvious by the prolonged flashes with each weapon's impact against them. Finally, before her shields could be breached, the Aurora jumped away in a brilliant blue-white flash of light, leaving the Dusan battleship's guns spewing into the void of space. As the overhead shield flashed with the incoming weapons impacts, Sergeant Eliason's squad of six ran across the compound toward the above-ground entrance to the prison's subterranean levels. As the entire Delta group moved into position, Echo and Foxer groups also made their way to their planned points of entry. Now leaning against the structure, Sergeant Eliason watched as Corporal Mitchell and Specialist Parquette placed the entry charges on the heavy door leading to the levels below. With the charges set, the two men moved clear of the door.
"Fire in the hole,"
Specialist Parquette warned. A moment later, the charges detonated. Within seconds, similar detonations occurred all over the compound as the other teams gained entry as well. Seconds after that, the smoke cleared, revealing a gaping, irregular hole in the door.
"Gaze and Inchin with me," the sergeant ordered. "Mitchell, you follow with Parquette and Prisk."
"Got it,"
Corporal Mitchell acknowledged. Sergeant Eliason waited for Specialist Gazin and Inchin to enter the hole in the door and head down the stairs. Then he followed them inside.
"Delta Blue is going in," he reported over comms.
"Delta Red has overwatch,"
Master Sergeant Anwar assured him. Specialist Gazin and Inchin reached the doorway at the bottom of the stairs, followed a few seconds later by Sergeant Eliason, and a few seconds after him by the rest of Delta Blue squad.
"Can't blast our way in here," Specialist Gazin told the sergeant. "No place to take cover."
"We'll have to cut our way through,"
Sergeant Eliason realized. That'll take a minute, Gazin reminded him. They'll be waiting for us on the other side.
Can't be helped, the sergeant said. Start cutting.
Gazin and Inchin pulled out their laser torches and began cutting through the inner door at the bottom of the stairwell.
This sucks, Corporal Mitchell said, coming down to stand next to his friend, Sergeant Eliason. Pop some stunners, dive and roll firing, and scramble for the far side of the foyer for cover, then toss incendiaries in both directions.
You feeling like a hero today, Sarge?
Nope, Sergeant Eliason said, grinning. Like a kick-ass gotta Jacques.
Incendiaries and stunners, Corporal Mitchell called back to his men behind him. Pass them down.
Volk Gucci pressed the jump button on his flight control stick, causing the pale blue light to spill out over his gun Yoki fighter's hull. A second later, the view outside his canopy changed, and he found himself in the middle of a battle between the Aurora and three Dusan frigates, with Cobra gunships jumping in and out trying to help.
Striker three, Captain Ash's voice called over comms. Target the frigate to your starboard side. Flip 1-7 Charlie, then back to rally 472.
Starboard frigate. Flip 1-7 Charlie, rally 472, Kenji repeated.
Striker 1's jump flash filled Vol's cockpit as the Cobra gunship jumped away, avoiding an incoming missile that now streaked past Vol's fighter, nearly missing his port engine nacelle.
That was close, Tariq exclaimed over comms. Oh, you're still with me, Vol joked. Pretty good for someone who has never won a major heat, he added as he turned toward the same frigate as Striker 3 was targeting. Follow me in, too.
No way you can shake me, old man, Tariq teased.
As soon as the gunship breaks to jump, I'll launch a full spread of shield busters. You follow with your main plasma cannons.
Got it, Tariq replied confidently.
Striker 3 engaging, Aiden's voice announced over comms. Striker 3, Shenza 1, do me a favor and break left after your attack run. That should set us up nicely.
Understood, Aiden replied as he opened fire on the frigate before him.
Vol steered his gun Yoki fighter directly behind Aiden's gunship, preparing his next jump as he followed the young pilot toward the target.
Busters ready? He asked his weapons officer behind him.
Eight of them set to launch,
Issa replied from the back of the cockpit. Just give me a clear shot.
You should have one in.
Vol glanced at his console, quickly assessing the rate the gunship in front of him was closing on the frigate.
6 seconds.
5 seconds later, the gunship in front of him ceased fire, rolling into a turn to port, and disappeared in a blue-white flash of light that nearly blinded Vol.
Clear line of fire, he told his weapons officer.
Firing, Issa announced.
Eight stubby missiles leapt from the big square pods on either side of the gun Yoki fighter's fuselage and streaked ahead of them toward the frigate. The missiles slammed into the frigate's shields, causing them to overload. Emitters on the frigate's starboard side overheated and exploded, causing her shields to collapse. Vol pitched up, not wanting to take the same escape jump line as Striker 3, and pressed his jump button before the enemy frigate could open fire on him. A split second later, he was in the clear and continued pitching up to come over and back toward the same target. As he came around, Shenza 2 appeared just above him.
Son of a bitch! Tariq exclaimed over comms.
Did you get him?
Vol asked excitedly.
No, the pussy jumped away as soon as you took out his shields.
These guys aren't stupid, Vol pointed out.
I still say they're pussies, Tariq insisted.
Vol chuckled to himself as he came out onto his return heading and tapped his jump button again. Both Ronnie's shuttles flew through the gaping hole in the blast doors and into the transfer tunnel. With only seconds to react, both ships fired their strapped-on plasma cannons, blowing holes not quite big enough for their ships to fit through into the inner doors at the end of the transfer tunnel. The ships continued down the short tunnel, diving into the holes they had just created. Both ships came to a sudden stop when the front half of their shuttles jammed into the holes. General Tellus quickly shook off the startling effects of the sudden stop as his pilot activated the explosive bolts holding their forward windows in place. The window panels blew outward, flying into the pressurized hangar deck in front of them. General Tellus stood up, climbed over the console, and squeezed through the opening. He then slid down the nose of the shuttle, landing on the hangar deck in front of the ship. He looked to his right as Master Sergeant Willem slid out through the forward windows of his shuttle in the same fashion, and then down to the deck as well. General Tellus brought his weapon up to a ready position, immediately sweeping the massive hangar bay for threats, but found none. He signaled the Master Sergeant to move to the right while he went left.
Alpha, disembark, fan left, he ordered quietly over comms. Bravo, disembark, fan right, the master sergeant ordered his men in the other shuttle. As the other Gatajak climbed out of their shuttles and followed, General Tellus moved quickly toward the far bulkhead, staying in a low crouch as he moved his weapon back and forth. He made his way to the wall and moved forward toward the far hatch. The hatch itself had undoubtedly sealed automatically when the inner doors had been breached. He glanced at the environmental display on the inside of his visor, noting that although it was lower than normal, the hangar bay was still pressurized and the pressure was slowly sealing. As expected, the inner doors were the type which automatically sealed around any object that penetrated them. General Tellus looked back toward the shuttles, noting that all 12 Gatajak, including himself, as well as their two pilots, had made it out of the shuttles and had found safe cover. He reached up and tapped the comms controls on the side of his combat helmet, changing comms channels. Alpha and Bravo teams are inside. Sergeant Eliason attached the extra grenades to his body armor as specialists Gazin and Inshin finished cutting through the door at the bottom of the stairs. As soon as they finished, the men stowed their laser torches and readied their assault rifles, in preparation to enter with their squad leader. The sergeant looked back at Corporal Mitchell, who was standing a few steps up, along with the other two members of the squad. The corporal nodded to Eliason, signaling that they were ready as well. Sergeant Eliason looked at Gazin and Inshin, both of whom had grenades in hand, ready to deploy. The sergeant kicked the door, causing the cutout to fall inward. Gazin and Inshin tossed their stunner grenades through the door in opposite directions, after which the sergeant tossed his incendiary grenades as well. Four flashes of blinding light and sensory deafening sound went off in the corridor beyond the door, followed by four explosions that sent burning gases expanding in all directions, filling the corridor. The sergeant waited several seconds for the flashover to finish, then dove headfirst through the doorway. He landed in a tuck and roll, coming up firing with his assault rifle, first left and then right. Four more grenades came flying through the doorway, again to the left and right. The sergeant spun around to face the wall as he activated the sensory protection fields in his combat helmet. The room flashed again, and Gazin and Inshin entered as well, stepping quickly through the door as they opened fire, Gazin to the left and Inshin to the right. It was a classic Gatajak entry maneuver, practiced countless times over the years of training together on Burgess. The process repeated two more times, allowing the other members of the team to enter, and for Eliason and his men to move down the corridor, pushing the Dusan defenders back. Section by section, Sergeant Eliason and his men advanced in the face of heavy resistance. Energy weapons fire ricocheted in all directions, as red and yellow energy bolts were exchanged by both sides. Multiple times, the sergeant felt bolts of energy slamming into his body armor, threatening to knock him off his feet. Had he not been wearing it, he surely would have been dead by now. The sergeant moved to the next doorway, crouching down low to avoid the heavy weapons fire coming from the next section. A Dusan grenade bounced past him, rolling further down the corridor toward his men. "Grenade!" he yelled in warning as he jumped up, running toward the bouncing grenade. Leaning over as he ran, he grabbed the grenade, twisted around in the air, and tossed it back in the direction it had come. The grenade detonated as it passed through the doorway, wrecking the door frame and the wall in the blast. On his back, the sergeant fired continuously in the direction of the blast, as his men advanced past him on either side, adding their own weapons fire to the barrage. Once at the doorway, the two men stopped firing and tossed their own grenades further down the corridor, then continued firing so the enemy would not be able to grab the devices and toss them back the way the sergeant had. Two more explosions rocked the next corridor. Sergeant Eliason took advantage of the break in the enemy barrage, scrambling back to his feet and charging forward through the doorway into the fray. The sergeant stayed low, knowing that his men would stay high as they came in behind him, firing as well. All three assault rifles blazed, sending a constant barrage of fire. Within seconds, three more rifles joined them, creating an unsurvivable wall of energy. After nearly a full minute of constant fire, the sergeant signaled his men to cease fire. All six of them stood motionless in the smoke-filled corridor, waiting and listening for an indication of life ahead of them. The sergeant checked his tactical display. His combat system showed no human signatures nearby, other than a few who were barely alive and not moving. The sergeant signaled his men to advance into the swirling smoke. They moved forward slowly, their weapons held high and ready to fire, moving back and forth, searching for targets. 10 meters further down the corridor, the room widened into what appeared to be a makeshift cell block. Sergeant Eliason moved inside, approaching the nearest cell carefully. As he reached the bars, he spotted six men cowering in the corner.
"Are you Coronari?" he called to them.
One of the men turned to look at the sergeant. The man was older than the others by a few years, and appeared to have been brutally beaten in recent days.
"Yes,"
he replied with a broken voice, rising unsteadily to his feet.
"I am Sergeant Eliason of the Gatajok. We have been sent by General Tellis and Captain Scott to rescue you," the sergeant explained. "Identify yourself."
"Then it is true," the man said in disbelief. "Nathan is alive?"
"He is."
The sergeant looked more closely at the man. "Do I know you, sir?"
"I am Major Jonas Pritchett of the Coronari and of the Alliance."
He tried to smile. "Retired, of course," he added, nearly breaking into tears.
"Of course, Major,"
the sergeant replied, coming to attention and holding a salute. Major Pritchett raised his hand and returned the salute as best he could.
"Assemble your men, Major," the sergeant said, lowering his hand. "We're getting you all out of here." "Thank you, Sergeant. I hope you have a big ship," Major Pritchett said.
Sergeant Eliason got a puzzled look on his face.
"How many of you are there, sir?"
"At least a couple thousand," the major replied.
"You have room, don't you?"
"Of course, sir," the sergeant lied. "Now please, we must not delay." Sergeant Eliason turned and headed back toward the door, signaling his men to help the Coronari. He tapped the comms controls on the side of his helmet to change comm channels.
"Saiki, Eliason, we're going to need more boxcars. A lot more."
Sue Van Navarro wrestled with the controls of his damaged crawler as the precious atmosphere around him leaked rapidly into the vacuum outside. He could feel the oxygen levels decreasing, his breathing becoming more difficult, and his vision blurring. He glanced at his environmental readings, which were dancing all over the place. He had only seconds left as he managed to guide his crawler through the blasted open hangar doors and into the transfer tunnel on the other side. Before him, he could barely make out the sterns of two Ronnie shuttles, their noses stuck into the doors at the far end of the tunnel. He urged the crawler forward, hoping to find one of the crawler docking stations that he knew existed inside the tunnel, but with each passing second, his ability to focus on distant objects faded. Even his near vision was becoming blurry when his console finally indicated it had detected a nearby docking port. Suvan pressed the emergency docking sequencer, praying that the damaged crawler still functioned well enough to auto-dock. The crawler surged clumsily forward, rocking from side to side as it struggled to reach the docking port only 10 meters away. As Suvan fought to stay conscious, he felt his crawler hit something. Something solid. A moment later, the door behind him popped open, and a rush of air slammed into his back, pushing him to the front of the tight confines of the crawler's interior. Suvan gasped, taking in a deep breath of properly oxygenated atmosphere. The darkness around the periphery of his vision began to clear, and his eyes began to focus again. The drowsiness, which had nearly taken him over, faded with each gasping breath he took, until finally his wits returned. Shaking off the effects of oxygen deprivation, Suvan reached back and up, grabbing the handles and pulling himself through the exit hatch behind him. Still feeling uncoordinated, he fell backward through the crawler's exit hatch into the transfer airlock. He pulled his feet out of the crawler and rolled over, crawling on his belly the few meters to the inner door controls. The inner doors opened and Suvan fell through into the next compartment. The sound of energy weapons fire rang out from the next compartment, then from the corridor just beyond the nearby hatch. Still on the floor, Suvan looked around, somewhat dazed, searching for a weapons locker, a heavy tool, anything he could use as a weapon. As the weapons fire grew closer, the screams of pain and anguish from the men being wounded filled his ears, causing him to scramble for cover. But it was too late. Suddenly a man stood before him in flat black full-body armor. Suvan looked up at the man. His face was covered with a polarized faceplate. The man looked down at him, and his faceplate retracted into his helmet.
"Captain Navarro, I presume?"
"I am General Lucius Tellis, leader of the Gatajok forces serving Captain Nathan Scott in the Karazari Alliance. We are here to assist you, sir." Captain Navarro rolled onto his back, relief washing over him.
"Pleasure to meet you, General."
"Time is of the essence, Captain," the general urged. "Just give me a moment to catch my breath," Captain Navarro said. General Tellis knelt down beside Captain Navarro, pulling a pneumo-ject out of a pocket on his thigh armor.
He dialed in the proper medication and dosage and then pressed the device against the captain's thigh.
This will help you recover more quickly, Captain.
Thank you, Suvan said, already feeling his strength and mental clarity returning. General Tellus tapped the comms controls on the side of his helmet, adding a second comms channel.
This is Tellus. We have made contact with Captain Navarro and are headed for the bridge.
Tellus, Vasya, the corporal called urgently over comms. Better make it quick, sir. We've got company coming from the port side.
Captain, General Tellus said.
I'm ready,
Suvan replied, sitting up. General Tellus offered his hand to the captain, helping him to his feet.
I believe you will need these, he said, handing a comm set and an energy pistol to him.
Suvan Navarro looked at the confident-looking man standing in front of him. He had known many Gatajak in his life, all of whom had the same confident gaze, a gaze that defied fear, that defied the very concept of failure. Suvan was actually beginning to believe they had a chance.
Jump complete, Mr. Bickle announced. We're back in the Darvino system.
Two battleships have joined the first,
Lieutenant Commander Kono announced.
Multiple gunships on the far side of Coronair. They're still trying to pound the Gatajak, sir.
What about the Saiki? Nathan asked.
Locking jump missiles on the two new battleships, Jessica announced.
The Saiki is battling the gunships, Lieutenant Commander Kono advised, but there's too many for them to deal with by themselves.
What about the Eagles and Raptors?
They're busy keeping reinforcements from reaching the prison,
Lieutenant Commander Kono reported.
Missiles away,
Jessica reported.
Bear on the nearest ship, Lieutenant, Nathan ordered. Then jump us into firing range.
Aye, sir.
Captain,
the comms officer interrupted.
I'm picking up a message repeat from the nearest comm buoy. The Gatajak have made contact with the Coronari prisoners and are preparing to move them into position for extraction, but they're asking for additional boxcars.
Why?
Nathan asked.
Ready to jump,
Lieutenant Denev reported.
Execute, Nathan ordered.
Apparently there are more Coronari prisoners than anticipated.
Jumping,
Mr. Bickle announced as the jump flash washed over the bridge again.
How many more? Nathan asked.
A couple thousand, minimum,
the comms officer reported.
I have a firing solution,
Jessica reported as the Aurora shook from the incoming weapons fire from the battleship directly ahead of them.
Open fire, Nathan ordered, a new sense of urgency washing over him.
Coronari filed out from the surface entrance of the underground prison and into the open as the shield bubble that surrounded them flashed brilliantly with each weapon's impact from beyond its borders. The prisoners moved out, instinctively seeking cover nearby, unwilling to trust the shield itself. Sergeant Eliason also came out, standing tall and looking around. He studied the inside of his visor and noticed that there were nearly 100 enemy soldiers encircling them beyond the shield perimeter.
Oh, shit, he muttered.
If that shield fails,
Corporal Mitchell said as he came alongside the sergeant,
we're all fucked.
The large maintenance bay along the topside of the Tayenta's engineering and main propulsion section flashed with white light as sparks fell from the massive overhead bay hatch. The sparks stopped suddenly, and a moment later a portion of the hatch, approximately 3 meters square, fell from above, descending rather slowly in the greatly reduced gravity of the empty bay. Immediately after, the first of 6 yellow and black crawlers floated downward through the gaping hole, their thrusters firing to accelerate their descent. One by one, they landed and began their ungainly crawl to the docking ports at the forward end of the hangar. The first 2 crawlers backed up to the docking ports, securing themselves first, as the other 4 crawlers stood waiting. Lieutenant Torin Rezik activated the egress hatch behind him and then pulled himself upward and out of the crawler in a smooth, efficient manner. Crouched down in the meter-square transfer airlock, he turned around to face the inner hatch and raised his weapon. He activated the inner hatch, causing it to slide open and jump through into the dimly lit compartment on the other side. The docking port hatch next to him also opened, and Corporal Chodan jumped into the compartment as well. Both men immediately turned and entered commands into the control panel beside the access hatches. The hatches slid closed again, and the crawlers on the opposite side of the transfer airlocks automatically disconnected and moved aside, following the emergency protocols, to make room for the next crawler waiting to dock.
"Check that corridor and then secure that hatch,"
the lieutenant ordered, moving in the opposite direction to do the same with the other hatch. The corporal nodded and moved away, disappearing through a hatch a moment later. Lieutenant Rezik moved through the other hatch and quickly down the corridor, his weapon held high.
He went as far as the next intersection, but found the next corridor to be just as dimly lit and abandoned. Satisfied that they were alone for the time being, he returned to the docking compartment.
"Nothing that way," Corporal Chodan assured the lieutenant.
Specialists Shervinkov and Baines jumped through the open inner hatches, joining the lieutenant and the corporal, turning around to close the hatches and make room for the last two crawlers. Lieutenant Rezik tapped the comms controls on the side of his helmet.
"Alpha Leader, Charlie Leader, we're in."
"Captain," one of the controllers called to Cameron from his station at the starboard side of the command and control compartment.
"Comms relay from the Takar system. General Tellus and his teams are inside the Tienta, and the general has made contact with Captain Navarro."
"Well, that's good news," Cameron stated.
"Comms relay from the Darvino system," another controller reported. "Aurora Actual is calling for more boxcars, as many as we can send."
"Why?" Cameron wondered.
"There are more Coronari prisoners than we thought, sir," the controller replied. "About 2,000 more."
"That might be a problem," Cameron realized. She turned to the officer on loan to her from the crew of the Glendannon.
"How many cargo haulers on board?"
"Just the two, I'm afraid."
"How many people can a single Class 1 cargo pod hold?"
"About 300 maximum, but not for very long. The life support systems for those pods are only designed to support 100 people for a few hours."
Cameron thought for a moment, then tapped her comm set. "Captain Gullen, Captain Taylor."
"Go ahead, Captain,"
Captain Gullen replied.
"Sir, I need you to set course for the Darvino system and be ready to jump there on my command."
"Are you sure that's wise, Captain?"
Captain Gullen asked, concern in his voice.
"Not wise, but necessary, I'm afraid. I'll explain in a few minutes. Taylor out."
"What are you planning?" the Glendannon's officer wondered.
"We're going to have to ferry them back to us," Cameron told him.
"Couldn't we do that just as easily from here?" the officer asked. "And more safely?"
"It's going to get dicey," Cameron explained. "We're going to need real-time comms to coordinate this, not this jump comm drone crap. Trust me."
"Trust me?" the officer repeated. "That's usually what people say right before all hell breaks loose."
Cameron sighed. "You're not kidding."
"The Aurora is jumping back and forth, carrying out attacks in both this system and the Darvino system, my lord," General Hessen explained. "However, their tactics in each system indicate a greater effort in the Darvino system by a 2-to-1 margin, and now we have reports of intruders aboard the Tayenta."
Lord Dusan looked at the general.
"The Tayenta?
I believe they hope to steal her from us."
"That's absurd," Lord Dusan insisted.
"Improbable, yes, but not impossible."
"But the security on the shipyards is..."
"Centered mainly on facility access and external defense," the general explained. "Since she is unfinished, security inside the ship is relatively light. Only 30 or 40 men guarding key areas."
"We cannot allow that ship to be taken," Lord Dusan stated firmly. "It will make us appear weak in the eyes of the nobles."
"More importantly, my lord, it will put a battleship in the hands of our enemy. I think that should concern you more than the appearance of weakness in the eyes of a bunch of pompous businessmen."
Lord Dusan glared at his longtime advisor.
"Watch your tone, old man," he warned. "You can be replaced."
General Hessen swallowed his pride before he spoke.
"Apologies, my lord. Sometimes, in my desire to ensure the success of your empire, I lose sight of my... boundaries." "See that it does not happen again, Hessen," Lord Dusan warned. "My father may have tolerated your free-speaking manner, but you will find me far less tolerant."
"My lord," the general nodded, showing respect to his leader, despite his contempt for the younger man.
"May I offer some advice, my lord?"
"Speak, but carefully," Lord Dusan warned.
"Recall our ships from Darvino to protect the shipyards and the Tayenta."
"And give them over 2,000 trained men? Are you mad?"
"They are only men, my lord. Men do not win interstellar wars. Ships win such wars."
Lord Dusan did not like the general's recommendation.
"I have a better idea, General. Our battleship shall continue defending the Darvino system, and they shall prevent the rescue of the Coronari."
"And the Tayenta?" General Hessen asked, his tone a subtle challenge to his leader's desires, despite his earlier warning.
"I shall protect the Tayenta," Lord Dusan told him, after which he stuck his finger in the general's chest and added, "You just see that those Coronari do not get away, for I shall hold you personally responsible if they do."
Lord Dusan turned around with a huff and started toward the exit.
"Notify my flagship," he barked. "I will arrive to take command momentarily."
General Hessen stood there, silently watching as Lord Dusan stormed out of the command center.
"That man's ego will be our undoing," he said to himself.
"Helm turn to 170, 20 degrees down relative," Nathan ordered. "Once established, jump ahead one light minute."
170, 20 down relative,"
Lieutenant Deneuve replied as she initiated the course change.
"One light minute, aye,"
Mr. Bickle replied. "Status of that battleship?" Nathan inquired.
"Shield numbers 4 and 5 are at 50%, 12 and 14 at 40%,
Lieutenant Commander Kono replied.
"Recommend targeting shield sections 4 and 5,
Jessica advised. "Two of her 6 reactors are directly underneath."
"Agreed," Nathan replied. "Comms tell the Cobras to attack the battleship's number 4 and 5 shields on an attack heading of 170, 20 down relative. Attack at..."
Nathan glanced at the mission clock, then at the status of their turn, doing quick calculations in his head in the split-second pause.
"Plus 12.30.
"Aye, sir,"
the comms officer replied.
170, 20 down relative,"
Lieutenant Deneuve announced, notifying her captain that the ship was on the assigned course as requested.
5-degree up-angle on the bow and jump us into attack range," Nathan instructed. "Ready all forward tubes, full power triplets, 4 rounds, then we jump ahead another light minute."
"Message away,"
the comms officer reported.
"Jumping,"
Mr. Bickle announced as the jump flash washed over the bridge. A black and crimson Dusan battleship appeared before them, filling most of the upper portion of the Aurora's wraparound view screen.
"Firing all forward tubes," Jessica announced.
"Adjust your angle as we pass, Lieutenant,"
Nathan instructed his helmsman. Red-orange flashes of light filled the bridge as waves of plasma torpedoes leapt from the Aurora's bow, slamming into the enemy battleship's number 4 and 5 shields, causing them to glow in similar hues with each impact. By the time the third round of plasma torpedoes left the Aurora's launch tubes, incoming fire had already begun shaking the ship violently.
"Forward shields are down to 30%,
the weapons officer warned. Nathan counted the wave of plasma torpedoes as they left the tubes, and as the fourth wave left, he ordered the next jump. Lieutenant Rezik ran down the corridor, leading his men into enemy fire from the opposite end. Blue bolts of energy slammed into his body armor as he charged forth, firing his weapon at each source of the incoming fire as it appeared. In true Gatajok style, one shot, one kill. By the time he and his men reached the end of the corridor, there were 12 dead Dusan soldiers. The lieutenant stood at the intersection, back against the wall, using the tactical sensor system and display on his visor to search the surrounding areas for targets.
"If these are Xenonor, we've got nothing to worry about," Corporal Chodan said as he came to stand next to the lieutenant.
"These are not Xenonor," the lieutenant stated. "I doubt they are even Dusan."
"Conscripts?" the corporal wondered.
"Most likely."
3 groups of red icons appeared on his visor display.
"Take Baines and Malin and intercept the bandits coming around the starboard side," he instructed. "I'll take Chervenkov and Caulfield to port."
"What about the guys coming up the center?" the corporal wondered.
"They will likely go to either side or possibly split up and go in both directions. That will draw them to us. If you finish off your first targets before the center group reaches you, move forward and circle in behind them."
"Got it,"
the corporal replied. The lieutenant glanced at the mission time display on his visor.
"And move quickly, Corporal. We are already 1 minute behind schedule."
"Don't blame us,"
the corporal said as he moved toward starboard, signaling specialists Baines and Malin to follow him.
"It's the enemy who's refusing to die quickly."
The Seiki came out of her jump dangerously close to one of the 3 Dusan gunships loitering over Coronair and bombarding the Gatajok shield from orbit. As soon as she appeared, she opened fire, sending balls of plasma energy slamming into the gunship's shields, causing them to flash with each impact. Josh rocked in his seat as the Seiki shook violently from the incoming fire, lighting up their shields.
"We can't take more than a few seconds of this," Loki warned. "Not from this range."
"No shit,"
Josh agreed in earnest. He snap-rolled the ship to the right, rolling into an inverted position relative to the target as they started their pass over it, thus allowing his gunners better lines of fire.
"Damn!"
he exclaimed as a direct blast nearly knocked him out of his seat.
"We need better restraints in this thing."
"Take that, you son of a bitch!"
Marcus explained as he tracked the gunship passing over them with his double-barreled plasma cannon. Red-orange bolts of plasma leapt from his barrels, slamming into the enemy gunship's shields but failing to penetrate them. The gunship slid away from him as he rotated his turret as far aft as possible. The gunship disappeared behind them, and a moment later, the stars changed, and the violent shaking ceased.
"God damn it, kid! Where'd you learn to shoot? I thought you were going to get that bastard shields down for us!"
"I'm trying, old man!"
Josh defended as the ship began coming about for another attack run.
"Well, try harder!"
General Tellis continued down the corridor, maintaining a staggered gait and occasionally moving from one side to the other. His assault rifle was held high and tight against his shoulder, and he swept it from side to side, always ready to fire at a moment's notice. As he rounded the corner, two men in basic battle gear appeared 10 meters away. The men raised their weapons to fire, but the general was much quicker, firing 4 times in rapid succession, striking them both in the abdomen and lower neck. The men fell, groaning in pain and scrambling to bring their weapons up from the floor to defend themselves, but the general shot them both in the face as he continued past them. Suvan Navarro followed the general, watching in amazement as the man dispatched enemy combatants one after the other with equal precision. He marveled at the general's ability to remain completely calm and without emotion, even when engaged in hand-to-hand combat. In fact, as easily as the general was progressing toward their objective, Suvan wondered why they had sent 5 others along with him. Without warning, shots rang out from behind. Energy bolts streaked past Suvan's head with a sizzling sound, slamming into the bulkheads beyond. He immediately ducked, running to one side of the corridor as the Gattajak behind him returned fire. He felt someone grab his shoulder and yank him forward, dragging him stumbling around the next corner. General Tellis tossed Captain Navarro about like a child, the assistive bodysuit under his armor providing him with the additional strength needed. With the captain safely out of immediate danger, the general peeked around the corner, quickly withdrawing as incoming fire flew past him. He made the calculations in his head and then leaned back around the corner, firing 3 shots. In the distance, beyond his men's position, the general's shots struck a large pipe running overhead. The pipe exploded, sending pressurized gas spraying all over the enemy's position. Corporal Vasya immediately recognized the gas as flammable and tossed an incendiary grenade toward the enemy's position, then took cover.
"Fire in the hole!"
he warned as he covered his head and curled up in a ball on the floor. The grenade detonated, igniting the gas. The explosion rocked the entire deck, sending a ball of fire down the corridor in both directions, like a wave from hell. Corporal Vasya felt the heat as the flames washed over him and his men. A split second later, the flames subsided and the corporal rose to his feet and opened fire, spraying the corridor with energy weapons fire. 10 seconds later, the corporal ceased fire, his eyes fixed on the swirling smoke between himself and the enemy position, waiting for any signs of movement. But none came.
"Clear," he finally reported. "Keep moving,"
the general ordered as he continued forward.
"Captain," he called as he walked past Suvan. "The bridge awaits us."
Suvan just shook his head as he climbed to his feet, following the determined Gattajak general.
"Jump complete," Mr. Bickle reported as the jump flash cleared from the Aurora's bridge.
"Darvino system. 3 gunships loitering over the extrication point," Lieutenant Commander Kono reported. 2 battleships now protecting the 1st battleship, which is still disabled. 1 of the battleships is turning toward us, Captain."
"The gunships are 2 light minutes out," Jessica reported. "I'm locking jump missiles on them now."
"New course," Nathan announced. "Turn to 356, up 60 relative. New jump, 1 light hour.
356, up 60, the lieutenant acknowledged.
"Confirming 1 light hour, sir,"
Mr. Bickle said.
"Confirmed," Nathan replied. 1 light hour.
"Aye, sir."
"Missiles away,"
Jessica announced.
"Sir, that will put us directly above the group of battleships," Mr. Bickle realized.
"That's the plan, Ensign," Nathan replied. "Jess, we're going to thread the needle."
Jessica smiled.
"I'm ready when you are, Skipper."
356, 60 degree up angle relative,"
Lieutenant Denev reported after completing her turn.
"Jump us ahead 1 light hour, Nathan ordered.
"Jumping,"
Ensign Bickle replied.
"Calculating target positions based on last known course and speed,"
Jessica announced.
"Hold your course," Nathan instructed. 90-degree down angle relative to the ecliptic. Steer a course directly between the calculated position of those battleships 1 minute from now. Make sure we'll pass just astern of the ship they're protecting."
"Aye, sir,"
the lieutenant confirmed.
Roll as needed to bring our broadsides to bear on the targets as we pass between them, he added.
Aye, sir, pitching down and adjusting course for optimal attack angle.
1 minute to jump, Mr. Bickle reported. The stars outside shifted slightly as the Seiki came out of its jump less than 2 kilometers above the 3 Dusan gunships currently bombarding the Gottesjok shield from above.
Ready to start extrication,
Sergeant Eliason's voice called over comms as they came out of the jump.
But you have to get those gunships off us first or we'll never get out alive.
Josh immediately opened fire, sending a stream of plasma bolts toward the distant group of gunships. Flashes of light appeared in the area of the distant gunships, followed by multiple explosions.
What the?
Josh said in shock.
I got them?
You didn't get them, Loki corrected. But somebody did.
Nice shooting, boys,
Sergeant Eliason congratulated. Now just keep them away for 10 more minutes and we're home free.
Who the hell took them out?
Josh wondered.
It had to be the Aurora,
Loki decided, checking his sensor readings. There were jump flashes just before the gunships blew up. It must have been jump missiles.
Sweet!
Seiki to all Eagles and Reapers, Loki called over comms. Extraction is about to begin. Keep those ground forces at bay until our ground forces are clear.
Eagle leader understood.
Reaper leader, we're on it. Ready to jump, Mr. Bickle reported.
Ready on all weapons? Nathan asked.
Ready,
Jessica replied. Take us in, Ensign, Nathan ordered. Jumping in 3, 2, 1, jumping. Nathan watched as the view screen lit up with the blue-white jump flash. When it cleared a second later, there were 3 Dusan battleships, their black hulls trimmed with crimson highlights filling the screen. The already damaged battleship was directly ahead of them, slowly sliding out of the Aurora's path of flight, moving from the top of the view screen toward the bottom. The other 2 battleships were slightly closer and about to slide past them on either side of the screen. The view itself was alarming, especially since all 3 battleships were undoubtedly turning their guns toward the Aurora at that very moment. The view screen suddenly lit up. Red-orange plasma torpedoes streaked from under the Aurora's bow, and dotted lines of red leapt from her gun turrets, lashing out at all 3 approaching battleships. A few seconds later, the intensity tripled as the battleships returned fire, lighting up the Aurora's shields as they struck, violently shaking her crew.
Forward shields are already down to 40% and dropping, the systems officer warned.
Concentrate torpedoes on the far target, directly ahead, Nathan ordered.
Mr. Bickle, be ready to jump us 10 light seconds ahead once we have a clear jump line.
The Aurora dove down between the 2 Dusan battleships, all her gun turrets blazing. Plasma cannons sent bolts of energy slamming into the passing warship shields, and railguns sent unending streams of exploding projectiles the size of a small car, each of them exploding on impact. The enemy's shields flashed as they tried to absorb the energy. The flashing was so rapid that it appeared constant, with only minor fluctuations in intensity. As the Aurora moved between the 2 much larger enemy vessels, she added her broadside cannons to the fray. Unfortunately, the massive Dusan warship's shields, although diminishing in strength with a continued onslaught, held. The shields of the damaged battleship directly ahead of the Aurora did not. The view screen suddenly filled with yellow and orange explosions as the Aurora's plasma torpedoes finally found their way through the enemy battleship's hull, setting off secondary explosions that tore through the massive ship within seconds.
Both port and starboard shields are about to fail,
the Aurora's systems officer warned.
Clear jump line in 10 seconds, Mr. Bickle reported.
Hold your course and continue firing, Nathan ordered.
Captain,
the systems officer urged, becoming concerned.
Stand by to jump on my command,
Nathan ordered as the ship continued to shake under the bombardment.
5 seconds. Starboard midship shield is failing.
The ship shook even more violently.
Clear jump. Jump,
Nathan ordered, not waiting for the navigator to finish his announcement. The bridge filled with blue-white light once again, and the violent shaking ceased a split second later.
Hard to starboard and be ready for another 10-second jump, Nathan ordered.
Lock a spread of missiles on both targets and launch when ready. Sensors, damage assessments on all 3 targets.
The ship rolled to starboard and started a rapid turn, while all 4 of those addressed verbally confirmed their orders as they carried them out.
Missiles away,
Jessica announced. Nathan waited 10 seconds, knowing it would take time for the light of the battle from which they had just jumped away to catch up to them at their current location.
Primary target is destroyed, Lieutenant Commander Kono finally reported. Shields on the other 2 battleships were weakened, but no damage. Targets have broke formation and are steering toward the far side of the...
The lieutenant commander paused a moment as new sensor readings came in. Correction. One of the ships has jumped away. Based on course at jump, she's headed back to the Takar system.
And the other battleship? Nathan asked.
She's headed for the far side of Coronair, sir,
the lieutenant commander replied.
They're going to take over the bombardment of the Gadajak shield on the surface,
Jessica realized. How long until they reach firing position? Nathan inquired.
They'll have to make at least two jumps to get around the planet, sir,
the lieutenant commander replied.
5 minutes max?
Comms warn the Gadajak. They've got 4.5 minutes to get out of there before all hell breaks loose, Nathan ordered.
Captain, they can't move 2,000-some-odd people in 4 minutes,
Jessica insisted. Not people, Nathan reminded her. Coronari, big difference.
If we can slow those battleships down.
We're due to cover the Tayenta's escape in just over a minute, Nathan reminded her sternly. We'll come back when the Tayenta is safely away.
Aye, sir,
Jessica replied, biting her tongue. Change course for Takar and prepare to jump us in close to the shipyard on the departure side, Nathan instructed.
Jump complete,
the Glendannon's helmsman announced. Any contacts? Captain Gullen asked his first officer.
I'm picking up 3 battleships on the near side of Coronair, Mr. Lontu reported. Also multiple gunships, octofighters, eagles, reapers, and a Saiki.
The Aurora destroyed 1 battleship and the last 3 gunships. Another battleship left, possibly returning to Takara, and the last battleship is moving to take over the bombardment of the Gadajak shield on the surface, Cameron explained over comms. We're 10 light minutes out, so you're seeing old images.
I'm aware of relativity, Captain, Captain Gullen reminded her.
The Aurora advises that we have 4 minutes to complete the extraction before the battleship reaches firing position and resumes the bombardment. That shield won't last long under that kind of firepower.
Understood, Captain Gullen replied. I'd appreciate a better tactical picture up here, Captain.
We're launching recon drones to keep our tactical tracks current, Cameron told him. We'll uplink our tactical display to our sensor display.
Much appreciated, Captain Gullen replied. Mr. Aletti, tell our boxcars to make it quick.
Yes, sir,
the comms officer replied.
And make sure our weapons and shields are powered up and ready at all times.
You got it, Captain,
Mr. Lontu promised. Last time we were here, we nearly got our asses handed to us, the captain said. I'm not planning on going through that again.
Jump complete, Mr. Bickle reported. We're back in the Takar system.
Battleship deadhead, 10 kilometers parallel course, 20 degrees off our port bow, Lieutenant Commander Kono reported.
Missiles, Nathan ordered.
Already locking on, Jessica replied.
Target is jumping,
the lieutenant commander warned.
He was expecting us to follow him, Nathan realized.
New location?
Unknown,
Lieutenant Commander Kono replied. He must have jumped more than a few seconds out.
Scan the shipyard, Nathan instructed.
What's the status of the Tayenta?
Checking now.
Octos and gunships attacking from starboard, Jessica warned.
Point defenses are engaging.
Comms direct the Gunyoki after those Octos and get the Cobras after the gunships.
Aye, sir.
Captain, the Tayenta still isn't showing any signs of powering up, Lieutenant Commander Kono reported. But every other ship on the shipyard does. They're all spinning up for departure.
Type and number? Nathan inquired.
2 older Jung-style battleships, a cruiser, and 4 old frigates.
Helm, come to 050, 20 down and jump ahead 5 light minutes, Nathan instructed.
Just take a snapshot of all targets before we jump, and be ready to lock jump missiles on all of them based on the last known course and speed. It's time we shake the system up a bit and make them nervous.
Captain,
Lieutenant Commander Kono interrupted, I'm picking up weapons fire from within the Tayenta, specifically near engineering and near the bridge.
Then they're almost ready, Nathan realized.
He glanced at the time display. In 3 minutes, the Dusan would resume bombardment of the Gadajak position on Coronair, and their makeshift shield would not protect them for more than a minute or two.
Lieutenant Haddix rolled his Reaper into a tight right turn in preparation to come back around for another strafing run.
New column approaching from the east, Ensign Weston reported from the co-pilot seat, gazing out the starboard window.
Gadajak, Reaper 6, he called over comms. New column coming in from the east. 5 troop carriers and 4 technicals. Suggest you cover your east side before you drop your shields again.
Understood, Sergeant Eliason replied.
The ensign studied his tactical display before continuing.
Eagle 5 convoy to your south. 5 troop carriers and 4 technicals heading west on a side road. 1 minute from the shield barrier. Engage and destroy.
Eagle 5 and 6 will be there in 30 seconds, the pilot of Super Eagle 5 replied. The convoy of Xehanort troops sped down the side streets of Aitkenah, breaking out into the open as they reached the edge of the city and headed for the ex-Koronari base a few kilometers ahead of them. As their last few vehicles passed out into the open, two jump flashes appeared low in the sky behind them, revealing a pair of super eagles bearing down on them. The gun turrets on the technical vehicles spun around as they barreled down the road, opening fire on the diving jump fighters. The forward shields around the jump fighters flashed as the Dusan weapons fire slammed into them, but the shields held firm. The diving fighters opened up, spraying the roadway with a barrage of red-orange bolts of plasma. Dirt, pieces of the roadway, and dust kicked up in all directions as the bolts of plasma tore up the roadway and surrounding landscape. The bolts of energy walked up the line of vehicles, blowing them apart one by one. Three of the vehicles swerved, leaving the roadway and finding room to maneuver, but the rest of the vehicles were destroyed, erupting in six separate explosions. The burning vehicles rolled to a stop, and two dozen surviving Xehanort troops jumped out, running for cover and firing their assault rifles at the super eagles as they streaked low overhead, and then jumped away. Because she was not yet finished, the bridge of the Tayenta was lightly staffed with mostly specialists and technicians, whose jobs were to test the systems that had recently been installed. Only two of the men on the bridge were armed, and neither had any real combat training, having been trained only to basic levels. By now everyone aboard the nearly completed battleship was well aware of the intruders who were making their way through the ship, causing mayhem and death everywhere they went. In a vain effort to defend the bridge, the two armed guards lined up the technicians as a protective barrier between them and the door, knowing full well that whoever was attempting to seize control of the ship would likely require her expertise to do so. What they hadn't counted on was the skill and determination of the Gata Jacques. The hatch blew open with an ear-splitting blast, and a pair of grenades came flying over their heads, landing behind everyone. The two guards looked at each other, then ran toward the sides of the bridge as the grenades detonated, filling the Tayenta's bridge with blinding white light and a deafening sound meant to incapacitate. The guards put their hands over their ears, falling to their knees in pain. Seconds later, energy weapons fire rang out, and both men took bolts of plasma to the head, killing them instantly. General Tellus and his men stormed into the bridge, their weapons trained on the technicians who were also on their knees, the discomfort caused by the stun grenades just beginning to subside. The technicians looked toward the main entrance as a man in a standard jumpsuit, worn by crawler operators, entered.
"I am Captain Suvan Navarro, commander of the Avondal, exiled leader of the illegally deregistered House Navarro. I claim this vessel on behalf of all free Takarans. Assist in our escape and your lives will be spared. Refuse and they will end in like fashion," he said, gesturing toward the two dead guards.
The bridge of Lord Dusan's flagship, the Pon Azari, was massive with separate levels. The majority of the ship was highly automated, but every level of that automation was controlled by the 60-plus technicians stationed here. The doors at the command-level entrance to the bridge opened, and Lord Dusan strode out of the elevator. The two guards on the sides snapped to attention, their weapons held directly in front of them as if for inspection. No mention was made of the ruler's arrival, and only the command officers were expected to turn and face their lord while standing at attention. Lord Dusan strode confidently across the bridge, leading from the elevator, across the open lower two levels, and onto the command platform in the center of the bridge. Without a word, he moved to take his seat, triggering a multitude of tactical and systems displays, which floated in the air around him.
"Readiness?" he queried.
"All stations are manned and ready, and the ship is at full power and ready for departure," Lord Dusan's executive officer reported.
"Excellent. Take us out, Commander. Raise shields and power all weapons."
"Of course, my lord," the commander replied. "But should we not wait until we have cleared our moorings before we raise shields to avoid damaging the structure?" Lord Dusan cast a sidelong glance at the commander.
"There is a warship jumping around, firing weapons and launching jump missiles, Commander. I care not about how our shields might damage this shipyard."
"Of course, my lord." The commander turned to face forward. "Docking officer, cast off all moorings. Helmsman, thrust forward at 20%. Weapons officer, raise all shields and charge all weapons. Sensor officer, locate all potential targets and prepare to engage." The commander stood fast as he listened to the acknowledgments from all four officers. One satisfied that his orders were being carried out, he turned back to his leader.
"My lord, if I may inquire as to our strategy."
"Strategy?"
Lord Dusan stated. Our strategy is to teach young Captain Scott a very painful lesson, and to put an end to this rebellion once and for all.
Lieutenant Rezig charged into the Tienta's engineering department, blasting away as he ran. Behind him were five other Gadajak soldiers also firing. The men split to the left and right as the Tienta's engineering teams scrambled.